So you may have noticed in your perambulations about the Zendo during Kinhin that on the altar to the left of the incense censer is a little ceramic urn with a little ceramic flower on it. And most of you probably know this, but that contains the ashes of Richard Clark, my teacher many, many years, and many of us here. Richard was a very, you would really have to say, brilliant person. He was of the kind of Zen that wasn't the shouting, hitting, Rinzai intense style. He was more like Joshu. He was what Joshu's been referred to as being an expert in lips and tongue Zen. Lips and tongue. Having a tremendous facility with words, a deep knowledge of literature. And some of his talks were just amazing to me. The way these words flowed from the mouth of someone who actually, when he grew up, had a terrible stuttering problem, which caused him a great deal of embarrassment and social isolation, which he gradually overcame, most fully when he began practicing Zen. So I bring this up simply because I wanted to mention something, and this is also the topic of a koan that we're going to take up later in the Teisho from the Hekigan Roku. But Richard was, as part of his brilliance, able to read and translate Chinese, along with several other languages, incidentally, French, German, some Japanese. But he translated perhaps one of the most famous, finest examples of Zen poetry that there is, which is the Shinjin Ming by the third patriarch of Zen. And he had an initial translation, and I'll just mention the very start of this poem, which goes on for several pages in a small booklet that he actually had published. But the initial booklet, this was the translation. The great way is not difficult for one who has no preferences. And he took another look at this original Chinese sometime down the road, perhaps after more deep practice, and he changed that first sentence in a subtle but very critical way. Change it to this. The great way is not difficult for one who is not attached to preferences. Notice that, not attached to preferences. Now this poem goes on, I don't know if I'm quoting it exactly, but there is a line in this poem shortly after this one, and it goes like this. If you set up what you like against what you don't like, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you set up what you like against what you don't like, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. And this is a core teaching in Buddhism, and in particular in Zen. Now, the folks on Madison Ave, I'm sure right now, are just out of their minds over this, if they're hearing me, because their entire advertising industry is built upon creating, we could say, creating preferences where no preferences prior existed. They're experts at this. They're truly experts at understanding the human psyche, the human being, what motivates us, what scares us, what makes us feel good and what makes us feel bad, and they exploit it to the nth degree. So if you want to look at how they operate in kind of a most elementary, fundamental way, they need to, in the recipient of their advertising, first set up a standard that is almost impossible or perhaps impossible to attain. A standard of beauty. A standard of wisdom. A standard of elegance. A standard of fearlessness. Someone who the recipient of the advertising at that point in time clearly doesn't feel they are. And yet feels that if they don't become, they've failed. And they will be miserable and never be happy. Now that's the first step. Set up the standard and then to have the standard be so lofty that the person viewing this standard feels they fall way short. Now, here's the big thing. I have this thing here. And if you are able to attain it, if, because this is very hard to attain, this is a very rare thing. It's very expensive. It's very unique. It's almost priceless. Very few people have it. But if you get it, you'll be just like him or her. I promise you. If you get this rare thing, it will make better all the things that you worried you weren't, that you were afraid you didn't have, that you were convinced that you would never get. It will fix all of that. This rare, rare, almost unattainable thing. Sounds a little like enlightenment, doesn't it? I think that advertising is utilized throughout most human endeavors, even perhaps Buddhism. Now, where does this start? Where does this all start? It doesn't start just on television or on billboards or radio or print. It starts when we're very, very, very young. It starts when we begin to understand good girl, bad girl, good boy, bad boy. The world starts to get split up into two. Something good and something bad. Something that your parent wants and something your parent doesn't want. And this is very important because it's a matter of survival. And in the child's mind, it's almost at times a matter of life and death, a matter of being loved or not being loved. And if you're not loved and you're this vulnerable little child surrounded by a big, dangerous world made up of people way, way bigger than you that have all the food you need to survive and everything else, if you don't get the praise, you could be in big, big trouble. Now, as this child starts to grow up, they see through a lot of this, but they also begin to feel that they are agents, that they can make things happen, that they can decide to be the good girl or the good boy or the bad boy. And they start to become vulnerable to the advertising that permeates our whole society. And then they get to a point in their childhood where this really starts to operate in full swing. Probably late childhood. I've actually observed this process very tenderly and with great interest in my granddaughter, who now is 11 years old, right in the midst of this very vulnerable period in childhood where many kids, and we don't know why, maybe around 9 or 10, they become prone to a particular disorder. It's called obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. It's fueled, we feel, by a sense of anxiety. It's actually considered in the psychiatric literature as an anxiety disorder. Thankfully, in most kids in whom this crops up, it eventually dissipates, gets better as the child matures and learns. But what happens here is that the child feels that there's something lacking. And just like in the very small child, where something lacking could threaten your very existence, this child feels that they've got to somehow fix this right away. It's just too intolerable to look at, too dangerous. So what they do is they set up a game that you always win. You can't lose at this game. So they create the rules and they play the game and they win every time. So winning might mean if I touch this spot on the wall, then the bad thing I'm worried might happen won't happen. And a lot of this happens unconsciously. So they go and they touch the spot, and for a moment that anxiety's gone. They won. And unfortunately, like most placebos, it is very potent. It has a very excellent effect. As one of my friends likes to say, very good effective. But it wears off. The anxiety starts to come back. So remember now, this child is looking for praise, seeing advertising, watching Disney, Taylor Swift. She's beautiful. She has beautiful platinum blonde hair that is perfect. Her eyes are perfect. Her teeth are perfect. Her lips are perfect, her body's perfect, her voice is perfect. Everything about her is perfect. So the anxiety comes back. Oh, I remember when I touched that spot, it made it go away, so I'll touch it again. Oh, I won. Great. It's gone. Then again, and again, and again. When you're not near that spot, it's not stepping on a crack, it's touching something with two hands, saying an incantation. All these different things. I think we all understand this. And I bet you there's very few children that haven't at one time or another, or adults, have not been caught in creating a game that you have to win in order to make some feeling inside instantly go away. So advertisers know how to set up these games. Now, you don't win, but they always win. They set up a game that they always win. They make the rules. They set the standard. They know how the human mind operates. They set up a game, and they always win this game. My wife, actually, in college, majored in marketing. Sometimes we'll talk about the things that she learned. How to market things, how to prevent someone after they bought something from getting what's called cognitive dissonance so that they no longer want this thing because they have to continually advertise to their friends, this is a wonderful thing and made all the difference in the world. Remember, it didn't, but they keep reinforcing that this car is the best car there is. You got the greatest, you made a smart decision. Aren't you smart? You got the best car. Now, my first lesson in marketing happened when I was maybe 7 or 8 or 9. I was the oldest child in a family of 4, and we would sit around the dinner table, and after we ate all the spinach and chicken and whatever else we were supposed to eat, we were rewarded with M&Ms. They came out of a big brown bag. I remember this. And my mother would take the M&Ms and pour them equal amounts into 4 bowls around the table, Paul, Joyce, Ricky, and Mark. We'd have our M&Ms in our bowls, and then she'd walk away and start cleaning the kitchen, and we would be free to eat our M&Ms and then go do our homework or go to bed, whatever happened next. Now, being the oldest, I had been around the block a few more times than all my siblings, and I set up a little game. First, I noticed that most of the M&Ms were brown M&Ms, more than half. Now, in there were some really what you thought were precious M&Ms. There were red ones, and there were yellow ones, and there were green ones, and I think there may have even been blue ones, but there weren't many of these. Now, I also noticed something. I noticed, after experimenting, that there was absolutely no difference in taste between a red M&M and a brown M&M. It's just that the reds were more rare. So I set up this little thing with my brothers and sisters. I showed them how rare these other colors were. And I told them because they were so rare, they were worth several brown M&Ms. And now you can get the rest of the story. At the end of the meal, I had a bowl full of M&Ms. And my brothers and sisters had all the colored ones. And at first they felt really happy, but when they were done with them and I was still eating the brown ones, they started to have second thoughts about it. So you can see how this all starts at a very, very young age. Very young age. So kids grow up and they want to be special. They want to have something very unique, something that sets them apart. Something that assuages the anxiety deep in the human being that they lack something, that there's a lacking. And sometimes they, if they can't achieve the good things, they feel that they might end up being the loser. Then they flip the game around. Then they see if they can be the baddest of the bad. I remember Michael Jackson, I'm bad, and this whole thing, you know, this whole generation, the millennium generation, was brought up on being bad, like being incredibly bad. And then you had the rap music and the gangstas, and the baggy pants and the hat turned sideways and who could be badder and gangs and all the rest of it. It's an interesting Zen story about this, you know, in a playful way. I'll read you this. It's kind of funny. So these two masters, one was Chaozhu, who was actually Joshu, and Wen Yuan, these two masters. One day, Chaozhu and Wen Yuan played a debating game. They agreed that whoever won the argument would be the loser, and whoever lost the argument would be the winner. As a prize, the loser should give the winner some fruit. "You speak first," Yuan Yuan said to Chaozhu. So the following dialogue ensued. Chaozhu said, "I am an ass." Wen Yuan, "I am the stomach of that ass." Chaozhu, "I am the feces that the ass has dropped." Wen Yuan, "I am a worm in the feces." Chaozhu, "What are you doing in the feces?" Wen Yuan, "I spent my summer vacation there." Chaozhu, "All right, now give me the fruit." Oh. So, what's the point of all of this? This enhancing, this elevating, this making so critically life and death importance, the matter of preferences, and getting the one you want, cannot help but infect our practice. It can't help but do it. This is where we're coming from. This is what we're steeped in. When we walk out of Sesshin, we are back in a world of advertising. It's very pervasive. It permeates. It's created in the most expert way to understand your psyche all the way through. So what does Zen do? Zen, to some extent, exploits that. It exploits that. Now, it can be exploited in a way that masters really push it to the limit. They reject everything. Student comes in, makes a presentation. "No, that's not it. Go away. More Zazen." Student comes back. "Now I really have it. I know I have it. I've had this deep insight." "No, that's not it. Go away." Just over and over and over. The student is rebuffed, rejected, to push them into this state of total lacking. I'll never get it. I've tried over. I've done Zazen for 20 years. Still don't have awakening. I'll read you a little story about that. So this is a beautiful, instructive story. And so this master, his name is Taishan. And he tells a long story about how he came to Buddhism. He learned about it at age 13. At 18, he joined the priesthood. He did intense practice. He had flashing insights, great enlightenments. He describes this here. I began to improve as soon as I followed this instruction. He was told about how to work on the Wado. Remember, I read that piece last night about sinning, looking back. I began to improve as soon as I followed this instruction. On the second day, I suppose this is up Sesshin, I felt that I could not close my eyes even if I wanted to. And on the third day, that my body was floating in the air. On the fourth day, I became completely unconscious of anything going on in this world. That night I stood leaning against a balustrade for some time. My mind was as serene as if it were in a state of unconsciousness. I kept my Wado constantly before me and then returned to my seat. As I was about to sit down, I suddenly experienced a sensation that my whole body, from the crown of my head to the soles of my feet, was split. The feeling was rather like having one's skull crushed, or like being lifted right up to the sky from the bottom of a 10,000-foot well. I then told Master Yen about this indescribable ecstasy and the non-attaching joy that I had just experienced. But Master Yen said, "No, this is not it. You should keep on working at your meditation." Interesting. At my request, he then quoted from the words of Dharma, the last lines being, "To propagate and glorify the upgoing affair of Buddhas and patriarchs, you still need a good hammer stroke on the back of your head." I read that one more time. "To propagate and glorify the upgoing affair of Buddhas and patriarchs, you still need a good hammer stroke on the back of your head." I kept on saying to myself, why do I need a hammering on the back of my head? Clearly there was still some slight doubt in my mind, something of which I was not sure. So I went on meditating a long time, every day for almost half a year. Then while I was, and this is somewhat funny, he says it directly, then while I was boiling some herbs for a headache, I don't blame him for having a headache, I recalled a koan in which a question was put to Naja by another monk who, the translation's name was Red Nose. "If you return your bones to your father and your flesh to your mother, where would," and this is in quotes, "you then be?" So he goes on and on about how he struggled with this. And he said, "Again and again I could not answer." He was now working with another master, Master Meng Shan, urged me to work harder at meditation, so wash away worldly habitual thoughts. Each time I entered his room and gave my answer to his interrogation, he always said that I'd still not got it. You can see now how this is working on him. One day I meditated from afternoon to the next morning using the power of dhyana to sustain and press forward until I directly reached the stage of profound subtlety. Arising from dhyana, I went to the master and told him my experience. He asked, "What is your original face?" As I was about to answer, the master drove me out and closed his door. From that time on, I gained a subtle improvement every day. There was something about that. That rejection Later, I realized that the whole difficulty had come about because I had not stayed long enough with Master Xu Yan to work on the subtle and fine parts of the task. But how fortunate I was to meet a really good Zen master. Only through him was I able to reach such a stage. I had not realized that if one exerts himself in an incessant and compelling manner, he will gain some realization from time to time, lessening his ignorance. Master Meng Shan said to me, "This is like stripping a pearl. The more you strip it, the brighter and clearer and purer it becomes. One stripping of this kind is superior to a whole incarnation's work of another. Nevertheless, you know what I'm going to say. Every time I tried to answer my master's question, I was always told that something was still lacking in me. One day in meditation, the word lacking came into my mind. And suddenly I felt my body and mind open wide from the core of my marrow and bone through and through. The feeling was as though old piled up snow was suddenly melting under the bright sun that had emerged after many dark and cloudy days. I could not help but laugh out heartily. I jumped down from my seat, caught Master Meng Shan's arm, and said to him, tell me, what do I lack? What do I lack? The master slapped my face thrice, and I prostrated myself before him three times. And he said, "Oh, Te Shan, it has taken you several years to get here." So, all of this is just a preamble to the koan we're going to take up today. And this is from the Hekigan Roku. We've spoken of this book. And just to set this up even a little bit further, this is the second koan in the Hekigan Roku. I think it's no mistake that it's the second koan because its message is so critical. But the first koan, in a sense, sets it up. So the first koan is the koan about the story of Bodhidharma coming to China, and I think most of you know this, and he went to Emperor Wu of Liang, who's a great supporter of Buddhism, and had built temples and, you know, was very into just the loftiness of this wondrous religion, fabulous temples, monks and priests with robes and bells and whistles and everything. And then here comes this, what has been referred to as a barbarian from the West. He wasn't even Chinese. Here comes Bodhidharma, but he had a great reputation. So Emperor Wu Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" And this famous answer by Bodhidharma, "Emptiness without holiness." And then there was a follow-up question. The emperor is nonplussed, no holiness. Well, no holiness, who's standing before me? And Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." So that's just a setup for this song that we're going to take up today. This koan is number 2 in the Hekigan Roku, and it's titled, "Joshu's The Highest Way Is Not Difficult." And Joshu, incidentally, was this lips and tongue master I'd mentioned, very much like, I should say, Richard is somewhat like this wonderful, lofty, probably greatest of all Zen masters from Tang Dynasty, Joshu. So Joshu, teaching the assembly, said, "The highest way is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. With but a single word, there may arise picking and choosing, or there may be clarity. This old monk does not abide within clarity." Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not? And the koan goes on. A monk asked, this is a very brave monk. He's walking into the lion's den, the tiger's lair. He's confronting the great Joshu and he's trying to pin him down. This is Dharma combat. Monk asks, if you do not abide in that clarity, what do you appreciate? Here, the Zen is all about clarity, isn't it? It's about awakening, it's about enlightenment, it's about no attachments, it's about putting down, picking and choosing. If you don't abide in that clarity, what do you appreciate? So taking the question, sometimes I say it's riding the thief's horse. You get on the horse behind the thief and you ride the horse with the thief. He's riding the thief's horse. Joshu said, I don't know that either. Now the monk presses him. Since you don't know, how can you say that you do not abide within clarity? And then Joshu answered this way. He said, it is enough to ask about the matter. Now make your bows and retire. That's the koan. So Joshu, teaching the assembly, said, the highest way is not difficult, just avoid picking and choosing. But with a single word, there may arise picking and choosing. There may arise thoughts. There may arise distractions. There may arise a feeling of lacking. There may arise a wanting. All these things arise in our Zazen. Not just for us, but for Joshu, great Tang Dynasty Zen master. He said, but with a single word, one word, there may arise picking and choosing. And then the very next moment, there may be clarity. So I've got to hang on to the clarity. I've got to send this koan. I've got to go to this samadhi. If I don't, everything will fall apart. I'll be a failure in Zen. Remember that master. What do I lack? What do I lack? So Joshu's teaching here is this. This old monk does not abide within clarity. Sometimes thinking comes. How is that not coming from true nature? How is that not the body of Buddha? How is not that emanating am? It's shining it. But I don't want it. I don't choose it. I want something else. So I've taken this one whole body of Buddha and I've split it in two, the things I want and the things I don't want. And at that point, as Sengsan's beautiful poem goes, if you set up what you like against what you don't like, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. In the Diamond Sutra, there's a line here by the Buddha. He said, he who seeks me in form, he who hears me in voice, perverted are his steps upon the way, for he cannot see the Tathagata, one who has gone thus, as is, as it comes, moment by moment. Sometimes the M&Ms are red, sometimes they're green. A lot of the time they're brown. That's a brown M&M. That's a green M&M. Starting to get on the wavelength. Every single thing exactly as it is emanating it, shining it. Now, when we pick and choose, what happens? Remember that master who was told before his great enlightenment, you still need a hammer stroke on the back of your head. Remember that? What is that? Why did he need a hammer stroke on the back of his head? What was he doing? What was he making special? What was he making better? What was he clinging to? What was he rejecting? And in doing all that, wasn't he standing back from the world, picking and choosing, separated, lurching after one thing as he runs from another? Even though it was something lofty, it was enlightenment, it was kensho, it was clarity, he still needed a hammer stroke across the back of his head. So what does Joshu say here? In answer to the monk who said, well, if you don't abide in that clarity, what do you appreciate? And this is the crux of this koan, crux of our practice, the crux of awakening. Joshu said, I don't know that either. I don't know that. I have no knowing relationship. Incense smell comes, it's incense smell. Pain in the knee comes, it's pain in the knee. Distraction comes, it's at that point manifesting as distraction. I don't have a mind that abides somewhere. So I'll leave you with one more quote from the Diamond Sutra. Allow mind, having no fixed abode standing apart, to flow forth. Allow mind, having no fixed abode, to flow forth. So we'll end there today.